overflowing with love. I am overflowing with happiness. I am filled with the power to make a change, to create a brand new life. I am overflowing.
Welcome to the podcast of the Sunday Celebration from the Center for Spiritual Living in Huntsville, Alabama. We hope you feel the grace, the beauty, and the love of our community as you hear the message of the week.
Thank you. That was beautiful. I love how the music kind of puts me in a space. Don't you like that space that it creates? And then you can really get kind of strange like I am, and you can realize maybe we're more space than we are content. Ah. You know, we're doing this wonderful class by Locke Kelly, and I know some people have resistance around the class, but I absolutely love it because it's transforming me. It's doing amazing things within me. And one of the things it's doing, it's helping me realize that I'm not the local mind. You know, religious science, and it's a beautiful teaching, and I've taught it for 30 years, a lot of what they do is they work with the local mind to change the local mind, which is fine. But what if the mind is not, and it's really difficult to change the mind. I was listening to John O'Donohue, this wonderful Irish saint, and he was telling me, he says, your thoughts are very important things, and we all have thoughts. And he says, your thoughts create your reality. And he says, most of the thoughts come from your head. And in your head, the furniture in your head probably wasn't even installed by you. The people that install the furniture in your head from which you think in your thoughts aren't even your thoughts, not your furniture. So what if you change the furniture in your head? Well, and he says, now I ask people a question. I ask them, say, what are the 7 sentences you live your life by? And he says, if you really go within and you'll find that there are these 7 sentences that really kind of determine your life. And then he says, ask the 7 sentences you wouldn't go near. You know, what are the ideas that will set you free? Glory G was telling me about a fairy tale that she created. We went to a wedding yesterday, and she says, I'm stuck in the middle of the fairy tale. And the fairy tale was about a spider. And she saw the spider around her dog's little Fanny, because he's having troubles with his tail. So I don't know what the spider was doing around the Fanny, but anyway, the spider was around the Fanny, and there was a spider that was caught up in the spider web. And so she started realizing that maybe the spider web is the web that we all spin and that we get trapped in. And that's as far as I've gone with the fairy tale. And I said, so, well, what if a bumblebee landed in the spider web? And the bumblebee was now trapped by the spider's web. And the spider, who was complaining about being trapped in her own web because she had spun this thing and it was more than she wanted to deal with, now has a little bumblebee there, and the bumblebee's trapped, and the bumblebee turns to the spider and asks the spider, will you set me free? And if the spider sets, if she sets the bumblebee free, well then, in a strange sort of way, and what did the spider realize? That it all came from within? It all came from within so it could withdraw its web and set itself free. And so as we were sitting there at this wedding that's yet to be, and we're talking over this fairy tale that is emerging as we speak through wonder and curiosity, we realize that what if we're all here to set each other free? And some of us get caught up in the web of our creation. Anybody know what I'm talking about? And sometimes others of us get trapped in a web that's not ours, but we're trapped in that web. And yet we get to find that freedom. So this is what John O'Donohue's pointing toward. He says, what if we could, and he says, strangely enough, change your think and change your life is about having a new operating system within your being. A new operating system, you know, and so what if it's about learning to move from the conditioned mind into the beginner's mind. You know, the Bible says in the book of Revelations, I love it when I go to Revelations at the very end, and it says, and there will be a new heaven and a new earth. And the voice within says, behold, I make all things new. So a new heaven is a new consciousness, and a new earth is a new manifestation. And we are to behold from a beginner's mind a life that wants newness, that wants freshness. And what is required is that we get new furniture in our mind and that we learn to change the thinking. But it can't be our local thoughts. It can't be a better thought. What if we go into no thought? What if we go into pure awake awareness? that doesn't think. So Locke Kelly, in this wonderful class we're teaching, he uses the metaphor of the ocean and the wave. You all know that. You know, we think we're the beautiful wave expressing our unique beauty in life until we go into the depths of the ocean and we realize, oh my God, I'm really the ocean as the wave. I am really the creative intelligence of the universe expressing through the wave of David. Well, then there's a whole different operating system. There's this ocean of presence, this ocean of love, this ocean of truth that's not bound by a local mind, a local conditioned way of thinking. And that's the invitation for all of us to make that essential shift into a different operating system. Wow. You can be free of the web or you can be in the web. And I would venture to say you can even be in the web and still be free, because it's about not the way you thought it was. So, you know, Ralph Waldo Emerson says, we all seek to be certain, but the only to the degree that we are uncertain. Or he uses the word settled. We all seek to be settled. We all seek to have all the answers. We all seek to have our life working just the way we want to. I did this beautiful wedding yesterday, and the bride had a control issue. I reminded her that she has a bit of a control issue here, because everything was just had to be just perfect. And you know, everything that was supposed to be just perfect, it all kind of went awry. When her beautiful train knocked over all the plants on the thing, when she dropped the wedding ring before she put it on his hand. And so what do? When things go wrong, you goof on it, you have some fun, and then the laughter. And it was a beautiful experience because it wasn't controlled. So I had to ask myself, how am I evolving? And the theme for this month, I like picking a theme. It's a conversation with the universe. Dr. Ernest Holmes in The Science of Mind, he said, you need to have your conversation in heaven. Now, was he talking literally? No, he was talking metaphorically. To have your conversation in heaven is to have exalted thoughts, to have expansive thoughts, to have thoughts that are not burdened by me and my opinions and my judgments and my old way of thinking. And then there is this room for this great discovery. So the first week, I talked about the doorways. The doorways to the divine are everywhere. Oftentimes, the doorways are not what you think they are. There, you know, maybe your dog dies, like we were talking about Baby Speck. We're coming up on the year anniversary of her death. And how the beautiful thing that she's teaching me is that she's still here, that the love is still here. And thank you, Kim, for reading that beautiful thing in the book to remind us that love doesn't die. And so everything is a potential doorway for transformation, even the things that are uncomfortable when we experience anger. I remember my teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, when anger would arise, he would say, oh, there you are, my little anger. You invited in. What are you showing me? So instead of trying to get rid of the anger and treating the anger away and putting a positive on it, you know, that's the one thing we do really well in religious science. We put a pile of whipped cream on a pile of doo-doo. And we, you know, we affirm that this too is good, this too is God. And instead of saying, you know, this anger may doesn't feel so good, but could I surround that anger and embrace it? I was telling Tia, my husband asked me a spiritual question this morning. He said, you know, I'm going to a family reunion, and as soon as I'm with the family, it's not a minute or two later. He said, all my buttons are pushed, and I'm living in reaction. He says, so what can I do? I'm sure you all have a solution to that one, don't you? And I said, well, you know, maybe admit it. I said, when my mother would come to visit, within 5 minutes, she pushed all my buttons. And Trey would be laughing because he'd see me having a reaction around my mother, and then he reminded me, yes, she pushes your buttons because she installed them. I went, oh, and then I laughed, and then I realized, so what if we acknowledge that we do have reaction, we do have anger, and it's not about treating it away, but it's about embracing it and holding it and seeing it in a new way. Then it naturally unravels by itself because we're not making it wrong. In fact, it's an act of violence to try to change something that we are ashamed of or something that we think is unacceptable about ourselves. I remember when I first came into a Science of Mind church, I was 30 years old and I didn't know who I was or what I was going to do with my life. And I was asking the wrong questions. You know, how can I find success in the world? And I remember hearing my teacher say just casually, but it went in like a laser beam. He said, when you know that success is the law of your life, something you measure by the world's approval. You don't go begging on the world, am I a success? But you know that success is how you face every moment. You know, successfully, I hung up little ghosts in the garden the other day because it's Halloween coming up. And it was fun. Did I do it perfectly? No, but I did it festively and funly. Did I do the wedding perfectly with the control freak? Probably not, but I had a gay old time, and I think everybody else did too. Because when thing goes wrong and you play with it, then there's a way to shift how you participate in it. So last week, the exploration was how this depth seeks us. You know, and I wanted Remy to sing Something's Calling Me, but I didn't get the music to him for last week, so he sang it this week. But that was really for last week, that song. But it's about something is calling us a little bit deeper than it's ever been before. Something is seeking us. You know, the truth is seeking us. Could we say yes to it when it's calling us to a greater order of being? You know, my little Zen calendar yesterday was Deepak Chopra, and it said, we are the universe, and we confuse ourselves by thinking we're individuals. We are the universe. We are the universal mind. And yet we've been caught up in this local mind, in this identity as the small self, as the egoic mind, as the egoic self. So back to our wonderful class that we're teaching, La Kelly used the ocean wave metaphor. And if you didn't get that one, if you didn't get the spider and the bumblebee metaphor, well, here's another one that he uses. He said, we all think that we're this beautiful, white, little, fluffy cloud. We're each unique, and our job is to keep our cloud nice, white, and fluffy, not to be sad and dark and angry, not to be irritated and critical and judgmental, but to be Om Namah Shivaya, Om Namah Shivaya, my cloud is so perfect. And then one day you fall out of the cloud and you go, holy cow, I'm the sky. I'm the sky, and you're all the sky. These clouds are just the illusion of me as the separate individual. Well, you better all get back in your clouds right now, because we want to be a very special cloud. And then we go on this idea that I want to be special, you know. And you know, in the Course in Miracles, they have one warning about love. They say the great warning in love is not to find a special love, to think that that love is out there in that one special package or that special package. Because if love has equanimity, if it's all the same love, when this love awakens within us, huh? And so this week, I'm talking about the life of the question. I pulled out this little book, and I was going to bring it, but I didn't. It was a book called The Gardener, and Mary Ellen Barton gave it to me years ago. And it's just filled with questions where people come to the old gardener, and I think I've kind of risen to that stage at this 70 years of life, and they ask him questions. And in this book, a young girl comes and asks the gardener, she says, how can I find happiness? And the gardener laughs back at her, and he says, my dear, you can't find happiness. What do you mean? Everybody wants to find happiness in life. He says, my dear, you're making happiness like a commodity that's outside yourself. You know, Emerson says, you can search the whole world over for happiness, but if you don't have it within you, you'll never find it. And so he says to the young girl, he says, I noticed that you have a flower in your hair, a gardenia. And she touched the flower and she said, oh yes, I love the gardenia. It's my... You put the flower in your hair, were you happy? And she said, oh yes. So the happiness was there already. And you've just forgotten that it was right there, you know. So Locke Kelly, in this book, he says, it's important not to think that we get answers from the world, but rather we open to a discovery that must come from within, that we open to what is already there, that we awaken to a presence that we all share, and finally that we discover that we're connected to something so much greater than we thought we were, and it's just waiting for us. Now, all of you have grown up with Dorothy Gale from Kansas. Even you, I bet you've seen The Wizard of Oz, haven't you? Yes, you have. And you know that last scene? She goes everywhere looking for her. She wants to go home. That's what she wants to do. And she gets to that balloon. And then Toto jumps out of the balloon. Toto represents unconditional love. So she jumps out of the balloon to go for unconditional love, and the balloon takes off because the balloon was not her solution to going home. And then Glinda comes down in her big white bubble, and Glinda sees Dorothy, and she says, so what have you learned, Dorothy, after you've been chasing all over Oz for your answer? And she went within to the no mind, not the Dorothy Gale mind, but to the discovery mind, and she said, what I discovered was if I look any further than my own backyard, it wasn't there to begin with. Is that right? She said, that's right. In other words, home is right where you are. It's already there. Was that it? She said. She said, that's it. Why didn't you tell me? She said, because you wouldn't have believed me if I told you. You have to discover it for yourself. So I can go on and talk about clouds and sky and waves and ocean, but until you get a glimpse of the truth of your being, you're going to be trapped in that Shempa place. That's that place of reaction. Lak Kelly, he comes from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and there's a word in Tibetan Buddhism, and it's called Rigpa. In Tibetan Buddhism, Rigpa is the word that means the nature of mind. And the nature of mind is open-hearted awareness, awake awareness. It's not thinking and fixing and analyzing and comparing and judging. It's just the nature of mind. It's the sky of mind. It's the ocean of mind. And he says, and the other, the opposite of that, is Ma-Rigpa. Ma must mean not. And that means not Rigpa. You're either in awake awareness or you're not. And then he goes on to say a very, very big thing. When you're not in Rigpa, which is awake awareness, then you are caught in the root of all suffering. He's saying you suffer because you're stuck in your little mind that's caught up in me and my anger, my judgment, my fear, my story. Can you relate to this, Serena, a little bit? Good. The cause of suffering is a failure to recognize your own awake awareness. And the solution to suffering is in realizing and living from this open-hearted, awake, aware place that we all share. Wow. It's that simple. That's why when you did amazing, I said, what if the amazing thing is we could unhook from our thought processes? We could unhook from struggle and we could land right there in love, in acceptance, in freedom. We're no longer in the spider's web. We've set ourselves free from our narrative that just gets us spinning around in that place where we suffer. You know, it doesn't mean that you're not going to have heartbreak in life, you know? And the beautiful thing about a broken heart is it's an open heart. So I hope my heart will keep breaking open, you know, as life goes on. So he says, the shift from awake awareness is what makes effortless mindfulness possible. And then I want to give just a little taste of what he said it would be like.
Well, that's nice to say, David, but what would it be like if I lived in open-hearted awareness?
So in his trip to Tibet, he said, I had a moment when I did that shift. Now, it didn't last forever because, you know, that egoic mind will come right back. It'll snap back in. But he had a glimpse. And this is what he glimpsed. He said, it was a different type of calmness I felt. I felt alert. I felt compassionate. I felt embodied and energetically connected to everyone and to everything. He said, my emotions were more accessible, and yet they were more spacious emotions. And I related to them directly in a loving way. So when the anger came, I could be loving with it. I began to laugh as tears of gratitude flowed down my face, and this pervasive feeling that I thought was normal, which was anxiety and self-centeredness and fear, which had always felt like my normal part of who I really was, simply dissolved. I don't have to be anxious anymore. I don't have to react anymore. I've fallen into the heart and I can respond. Wow, anger arises. You know, I was telling Joanne, she was pulled by her dog and she fell and she experienced this anger that was just there, and it wasn't at the dog. And I remember Trey and I were walking baby Speck up on Monte Sano, and she saw a deer, and she took off, and she had the strength of a mastodon. And Trey went airborne, and he landed. And we both just laughed. What can you do? I mean, I think he was in a moment of open-hearted awareness. He didn't have any reaction. So what was here instead was a profound sense of well-being, a sense of unity, joy, and gratitude. And he said, after a while, my normal anxious self came back. But he said, this awake, aware place was in the background now, and I knew that it was there. That under the right circumstances, with the right technique, I'd use that little unhooking technique, maybe I could just fall back into that place that's just waiting for us. Glory G and I got to the wedding early, and the bride was getting all gussied up with her hairdo and the gorgeous dress and all the bridesmaids, and she asked that we do a meditation. And so we went in the room an hour before the wedding, and the bride sat down on the floor. It looked like Scarlett O'Hara. Her wedding dress was all around her, and she had her cup of coffee. I said, coffee stains, coffee stains. So I took her coffee away from her. And then Glory G so beautifully just created a field, and all the chaos and the screaming is going on around, and yet she took us into a place where there was peace and there was harmony, there was emptiness, there was freedom. And we sat in that beautiful place for a good 20 minutes. And then when she rang the bell and we ended, then the invitation is either go back into the chaos or try to contain that space so that we can then move forward in a flow of the evening. So that's when she and I decided to sit on the church pew away from all the 200 people, and we did our fairy tale of the spider and the bumblebee. And we were such... But then we had to descend and enter into the craziness of the action. but yet all the time keeping the serenity within us. Emerson says, if in all this crazy world you can keep the peace and serenity of your calm mind, then you will be part of the solution instead of part of the reaction. Because the world wants us to get out there and engage in resistance, reaction, and protests, and this is and that. And what if you could maintain that serenity of your quiet mind that's resting right there at the center of your being? John O'Donohue says the way to do that is to open up to the question. And so in this wonderful little book that was written posthumously by someone who really loved him, and I just recently got it, he talks about Socrates. You know, Socrates said, the unexamined life isn't worth living. So when we come to the center, what we do in the classes, and we're going to do it this Wednesday night, we're going to court a question. You know, and Socrates would invite you to ask the question. So what does that mean? My teacher would say, well, what does that mean to you? Or the question might be, what is true for you at this stage of your life? You know, when you were young, maybe you wanted to find love and you wanted to find happiness and you wanted to find success in the world. Well, there was a Freudian slip. And maybe at a more mature stage, you're seeking a sense of fulfillment in what you do. You know, it's in being content with what you do. It doesn't matter whether the world approves you. And what if it's about finding the love that's here already instead of looking outside yourself for it? Things are different. So he says, Socrates started raising the question. And one of the most exciting and energetic forms of thought is the question. And I always think that the question is like a lantern. It illuminates new landscape and new areas as it moves within us. So therefore, the question always assumes that there are many different dimensions to a thought and that you are either blind to it or that you are available to it and maybe not available to it. So a question is really one of the forms in which wonder expresses itself. This book is called Walking in Wonder. So walking in wonder is walking in the beginner's mind. It's not walking in the conclusion mind that has all the answers. And when you step out of the conclusion mind, you know, I was speaking to my little sister, and she comes from a fundamentalist religion, and she has a disdain for what we do here because there's a very narrow path in her mind as to how this salvation thing works. And I always say to her, well, what if you don't need to be saved? And that really kind of irritates her. So then I decided I'm not going to go any further because we don't seem to get anywhere. But what if you could have a spirituality that's always fresh and alive and new and that invites you to change and go to the deeper level? You know, Jesus himself said, you know, when two or more are gathered in my name, I am there. And what he meant by in my name is in my nature, in the nature of the Christ. So what if what we are here to do is to discover the Christification of humanity, the awakened humanity that we all share? You know, it's the Buddha consciousness, the Christ consciousness, and it's our consciousness once we let go of the idea that we're the egoic mind trying to find that thing. So he goes on to say, Martin Heidegger said that when you can conceive of a frontier, you're already beyond it, because a frontier, while it may be the limitation of where you now are or what you now feel or think, is also the threshold of what you are actually going to move into. Now, those of you who've been here for a while, Adam's almost been a year. He came when baby Speck died. He said the day he arrived, I was in Canada, and he announced that the baby had died. And he said, I wonder whose baby died. Well, it was baby Speck, my dog. But he's been here a year, and it's in that year, like so many of you who've been here, Seamus, 20 years, I've watched you change and grow and evolve, because that is our nature, is to grow and evolve. There is a premise in horticulture that says either grow or die. I hope you could hear that one. Either grow or die, and if you're growing, you must evolve and change. And someone said the only one that really wants to change is a baby whose diaper is full. So, I mean, you know, change is not an easy thing to sell people. You mean I have to change? They're the ones that need to change. No, no. You're lucky if you can even change yourself. And the way we change ourselves is by letting go of the attachment and the identity of who we thought we were. You know, we misrepresent ourselves. In the 8th Psalm, it says, what is man that thou art mindful of him? Thou hast created him a little lower than the angels and hath crowned him with honor and glory. So we are here to honor and glorify this very presence that we talk about, that we write about. And it's, how can it come through your life? That's a great question. How does this presence manifest in your life? For me, it comes through the open-hearted awareness. Gloria G and I were talking about all the many different paths of spirituality. And I've been doing this since I was in my 20s, and I'm 70 years old now. And I remember when I studied with the Tibetan Buddhists, They had a phrase, they called it spiritual materialism. And spiritual materialism means that you have a little of this and a little of that and a little of this, and you study all these different things, and you don't dig that one deep well. And so after a certain while, you want to just put away all these different techniques, and you want to find where that well is. And I studied with Sadhguru for quite a while. He's quite famous now. And in his spiritual path, it was always about finding the energy at the base of the root chakra and sending the kundalini, creating the third eye. And I thought that was the path that I needed to be on. But you know, it really wasn't. And then when I fell into line with the Sufis, I realized this is a path that feels natural for me because it was a pathway of the heart. It was about opening the heart. And we each have to discover what is the right way for you. It's not the same for everyone. So if you're here and if this seems to fit, perhaps the path of the heart is a path that works for you. I know it works for me. In the, you know, these are the yantras of the world religions, and they all point to this spiritual connection. There's the Taoist symbol, within the dark is the light, and the light in the dark, the yin-yang. It's not yin and yang, it's yin-yang. It's all part of the oneness. There's the Vesica Pisces, which gets a little bit bigger. There's the Star of David over there. It's not the symbol of Judaism. Yes, it is, but it's so much more. It's an ancient Hindu symbol of the upper three chakras over the lower three chakras, and they're right over the heart chakra. And so all these come in balance through this wisdom of the heart. So what if we get to discover, just like Dorothy did, what is the right spiritual path for us? And then once you discover it, well, then it's about stepping on that path of love together. At the end of the wedding ceremony, when I married Claire and her beautiful husband, I had them say this thing together. I now surrender to a love that binds us together as one, as we journey on this path of love together. What if we're doing that? We're journeying on a path of love together, and the love is what we are. And we're doing this together because we need each other like the spider needed the bumblebee. Because sometimes we get stuck in the web of our belief systems, the web of our commitments, the web of our very busy, complicated lives. And really, our freedom is right there from within us when we take it. I was thinking about the questions and how they're so... It was Rilke that said, court the question. Don't go seeking the answers. And as I was playing with this idea of questions, I started hearing songs. When I was asked to speak in London at the Prosperity Consciousness, they gave me the title of the talk they wanted me to give to them. First, they wanted me to do a workshop called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway, which is something I am not really good at, because when I get afraid, I get paralyzed and get white-knuckled and I withdraw. So I had to do a workshop on that, and I realized people are probably most afraid of love. So I had them touch each other and get intimate with each other. It was a great success. And then the final talk I was to give was, what's it all about? And like, I have all the answers. But of course, being that I came from the stage, I heard Burt Bacharach, and I remember Alfie, the movie. What's it all about, Alfie? Is it just for the moment we live? Again, quoting the question, what's it all about when you sorted out Alfie? Are we meant to take more than we give? And then just like true Burt Bacharach, he left you in this question, you know, what's it really all about? And then he gives you an answer. And he says, I believe in love, Alfie, for without love we just exist, Alfie. And until you find a love that's real, you're nothing, oh Alfie. And when you walk, let your heart lead the way and you'll find love everywhere, Alfie. Wow, could a simple Burt Bacharach song to hear, I believe in love. And when you give it away, you expanded. So then I thought, well, this crazy love thing and the questions, I remember George Gershwin. He also asked that crazy thing about love. What is this thing called love? How many of you have been in love? Love, this funny thing called love, who can explain the mystery? Why has it made a fool of me? Yeah, so Gershwin recognized that we fall in love and then we have our heart broken. Is that really love, you know, or is that attachment? And what so many of us think is love is really attachment and grasping and possessing and trying to control and trying to fix and thinking that we own something. And that's really not love, that's attachment. So then I hear the next question, also coming from the stage, a musical called Oliver, when the little boy, the little orphan boy, says, where is love? Where is love? Does it fall from skies above? Is it underneath the willow tree that I've been dreaming of? You know, where is she? Who I close my eyes and see? So he's got this love idea, but he projected it out into the world. Very normal to project that love out into the world. And so in this class we're teaching, he talks about glimpses, and you have inner glimpses of the love, and you have outer glimpses of the love. And you know, you've heard me talk about baby Speck, and we were talking about children, Adam and I, this morning, and I realized that she was like my child. You know, us gay people don't have, well, some gay people do, but I don't have any two-legged children, but I do have these four-leggeds. And when you get them from a very tiny animal like baby Speck was, she truly would sleep in my arms as a puppy. And she was like my child, and she had all the issues. She wasn't the perfect child, but yet she still is within me. So what if we do get those outer forms of love that are very, very necessary? And when we truly love someone, it's very important that we give them room enough to let them be who they are, you know, that we don't try to control them. We all know that in our heart. But yet the tendency is we want to have a good dog and a good child, and they have to behave, and they have to do the right thing. I got a little lecture in the circle this morning. There's the right thing, and there's the wrong thing, and we're here to do the right thing. Well, it may not be the right thing for baby Speck. She may have to go chase the squirrel and take Trey airborne, and that's not the right thing to do with an old man who has giddy-up issues. And yet it was what it was, and there's beauty in that. So then we get more refined in our questions, and we ask the different kind of questions. How can I discover, how can I uncover, how can I realize, and how can I awaken this something that's greater in me? And this is where I turn to Richard Rohr, this wonderful Franciscan monk, because he talks about polishing the mirror of our heart, cleansing the lens of our perception, and we're always cleansing it because we don't see things as they really are, we see things as we are. And as long as we're trapped in our perception, we're going to have the same demonstration, you know? What is the definition of insanity? Doing the same thing over and over and over and over and over and over again and expecting different results. So after a while, you got to realize the only obstacle there is my perception. My perception has created my projection, and my projection has created my suffering. So here's how this wonderful priest speaks about it. He calls it wiping the mirror. You know, life is it's a mirror. It reflects back who we are. And there's a beautiful old saying, you know, when you look in the mirror and you notice your hair is a mess, you don't go comb in the mirror, do you? Or do you? So, he says, mirror wiping is the inner discipline of calmly observing our patterns. And he says, what we see and what we don't see, in order to get our demanding and over-defended egos away from full control that they always want. Our egos want to be in control. If there's anything that I suffered, we did Dark Side of the Light Chasers when Jan had her ministerial class, and I realized the one shadow side that I have is, and you can always tell your shadow, it's the thing that you don't want other people to do to you, and I don't like other people to control me. So then I had to own that I have a control addiction. But then all ego has control because we want to be in control. And I was once having a breakdown under my Sufi teacher, and I'm sobbing. And he says, it's okay to cry, David. And I said, no, no, it's not. And he says, why don't you think it's okay to cry? I says, because I'm afraid I'm going to lose control. And he says, he thinks he has control. And I heard it. So in order to get our demanding and over-defended egos away from full control that they always want, it requires us to stand at a distance from ourselves and listen and look with calm, non-judgmental objectivity. And otherwise, we do not have thoughts and feelings. Rather, the thoughts and the feelings have us. Huh. They have us. They've got us. Shempa. Shempa is that beautiful Tibetan word that means, what is it that hooks ya? Ah, I'm hooked. I'm triggered. And then he goes on to say this. The recovery movement calls this ability sobriety. And he says, both agree that we must recognize our own games, our fears, and our filters. And what is my real agenda, he asks? And what are my prejudices? And what are my leftover hurts that color just about everything that I see? Again, the question, what is it in me that is being triggered, and how am I feeding that? How am I addicted to my own? And he says, by utilizing compassionate and detached observation of ourselves, God helps us to recognize our own depths and little by little, and only when we are ready to handle them. You know, that's why it's so important on this journey to be gentle with yourself, because they say that there are 70,000 veils of ignorance, and it's very important that you lift the veils one at a time and make sure you don't tear the veil. Wow. So there's my anger. There's my control. There's my fear. Here's some anxiety. Here's some, and you just peel them away when you're ready, and be gentle, because they're going to come right back. You know, I was asking someone, how can you deal with people when you have a reaction, like Trey asked me this morning, and they said, put a wall around yourself. Well, the wall's never really worked for me. I used to have the wall, but then when the wall didn't serve me, I think maybe I'm going to have to actually meet that very thing that I've been trying to run away from, and the wall isn't working so well. So he says, the older I get, the more I know the patience and mercy of the presence within my own soul. Huh. And as I ask the right questions, I begin to have different answers. We taught also a class here in the ministerial thing. It was called The Work by a lady. And this practice downloaded from the universe for her. And it was all about people who get caught up in a statement. You know, all men are jerks. This lady I knew in Atlanta, she used to say, all men are jerks. And I'd say, but I'm a man. She said, you're not a real man. So, oh, okay. So, and what do you think she attracted into her life? She attracted jerks. That's because that's what she had, this belief system. And so the mind will reflect back to you what you put into the mirror. And so what if we get to be impeccable with what we're saying, with what we're putting out into life? Because truly, the very first sermon I gave here in March of 1989, I remember the title of that talk, and it summed up the whole teaching of religious science for me at that young age. And I called it the boomerang principle. What you sow is what you reap. What you sow is what you reap. So if you say, life sucks, life sucks. Nobody loves me. Nobody loves me. Because that's the way the law works. And when you start changing your tune, you begin to have a different experience. Wow.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. For more information, visit our website at www.cslhuntsville.org. To create a brand new